Welcome to Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today is the author of four novels. He's won the Geoffrey Faber Prize and has been longlisted for the Man Booker. His most recent book, Let Go My Hand, has been brilliantly received. It's a darkly comic and deeply moving 21st century love story between a son, his brothers, and their father. Edward Docks, welcome to Meet the Writers.
Great to be here.
Can we just start with your name? So it's spelt D-O-C-X.
Yes, that's right. It was a tremendously cool name until about 6 or 7 years ago, when, or maybe a bit longer now, 10 years ago, when Microsoft stole it from us. And now it's kind of much less cool. So for the first 20 years of my life, I thought it was a great name. Now I'm less sure. We don't actually know the detail of it because my great-grandfather came over from Europe, and we think it's either from Doex, D-O-E-X, which is what my dad was told when he was little, and there's a place in Switzerland, another place in France called Doex, D-O-E-X, or it might be from a thing called the doxology, which is another theory we have, which is a rite, as I understand it, in the Catholic Mass. A hymn of praise is a doxology. So we think there might be some link there, but I'm afraid I can't enlighten you much more beyond that.
Well, of course, that's not the only mystery in your family life. Huge, huge mystery at the heart of your mother's life.
Yes, my I was born into a great family for a novelist because all sides of my family are a kind of chaotic, emotional and intergenerational mess. So it's hugely good to find material to write about. Yes, my mother discovered when she was, I think, 34, that she was Russian. She was brought up by a lady who I used to call my grandma, who was Indian, and a guy who I used to call my grandfather, who was a guy in the army, a guy called Ralph Partridge. And they were married, and my mum was one of three children, the middle one. But when the Indian lady, who I used to call my grandma, came to the end of her life, she was very ill, and she used to come to our house a lot. Just before she died, she told my mother that she wasn't my mother's real genetic mum, and that actually my mother's real genetic mum was a Russian woman. And this Russian woman had had an affair with the person that my mum called her granddad.
It's very complicated.
It is complicated. So my mum had basically what I describe as the opposite of a nervous breakdown. She went sort of euphoric and joyous for about 3 years and started listening to Russian classical music nonstop, Tchaikovsky all the time, and wearing these huge Russian dresses and filling the house with icons. And she really went for it, actually. Ballet pictures of her real mother was a dancer. I mean, not a particularly famous or good one, we understand, but nonetheless made it, I think, as far as the chorus in the Kirov. So we had all these ballet pictures all over the house, and suddenly we were all Russian, having been a quarter Indian. I was suddenly a quarter Russian. And then we set off to try and find my dad's family in northern France. So we've basically been in search of ourselves all our lives. But that's what novelists are like.
You write about it being a chaotic or eccentric family. It certainly sounds that. You're the oldest of seven siblings.
Yeah, I mean, I've just written a piece where I suddenly had this thought clarified to me, which is that all childhoods are completely normal to the people who live them. And that certainly was the case for us, a very happy childhood. And I'm very close to my brothers and sisters. But we did grow up in a really odd house, actually, looking back at it. So my mother and father bought a house which they probably couldn't afford, and we lived in it in the most scruffy, dilapidated way you can possibly imagine. A huge place, old rambling place. No curtains, no carpets, no furniture. Even the word upholstery makes me and my siblings laugh. No furniture, really, just kind of old stuff they found, and, you know, 1930s pipes that clanged in the night for reasons no one understood. Floorboards everywhere with odd nails, so you would walk through the house in a really strange fashion. People who would come and stay wouldn't understand why we would move through the hall in a really odd way, but it's because of all the nails. My mum, partly because she had seven children and also because she was quite busy as a classical concert promoter, just never did, and I'm very proud of this, but she just never did any housework, and I mean never. So, you know, we basically cooked for ourselves. we did our own laundry, and you know, we just there were at one stage I think 52 laundry baskets in the house just on the floor with the clothes in, and it was crazy. And then we'd have these concerts, and my mum would put on a big Russian dress. So it was an odd childhood actually, and we used to travel around Europe madly every summer in a van, because my mother and father they never had enough money, so they could never fly us anywhere. So we used to get in a van and just drive across Europe in this van, stopping at kind of madly. One day it would be a cake shop that my dad was particularly interested in. Another day, the birthhouse of a composer. Then we'd go motor racing for some reason that I don't understand. And then next day we'd go and see prehistoric cave. And then, so they, I don't really think they actually planned it that much. I think they just drove, and we used to camp. And I just don't know how they did it, but all of us used to camp.
So that would be nine of you.
That's nine of us. So we had three tents and the van. It was absolutely deliriously happy for us. God knows what was going on in their minds. But so we could go anywhere. We would literally cross the channel. My dad would take 3 weeks off from the surgery. And he would, if it was not very good weather, he'd say, well, let's go to Italy then. And then we'd just go to Italy. And then we'd go and sit somewhere in some field in Italy and look at the mountains. And then he'd say, this is very nice. Let's stay here for a bit. So we just used to live like that. And my mum is very full of energy, obviously, and very still a great lover of music and still does her concerts. And so what they concentrated on, I think, was just teaching us things. So they just used to teach us all the time. Mm. But yeah, quite strange.
I mean, all grist for the writerly mill. And of course, A Road Trip appears in your most recent book,
sure,
which we'll talk about in a little while. It's all being filed away. What's your first job then in writing? You were a journalist.
That's right. So, I mean, I'm one of those very, very fortunate people who just always knew what they wanted to do. And I began my writing life very young. I mean, used to write really, really bad short stories. And then won a poetry thing at school, which was quite an important moment, actually, because it sort of gives you that stamp that other people think you might have something. And then I tried to write all through university and usual story, didn't get anywhere. Then I got a job on a newspaper as a secretary on the books desk for so little money. I'm too embarrassed to tell you, it's before the minimum wage. And I used to open everyone else's books for about 3 or 4 years. And then I started to get writing gigs on that paper. By that time, I'd written the first novel and a second novel and got nowhere. The second novel got me quite far. I mean, lots of editors liked it, but just didn't think it was publishable. And I went over to America with it and got an agent in America with the second one. And very, very amusingly, he took me out for lunch, a lovely guy. And he said, look, you know, the book was about this guy called Jim, who was slightly overweight and was a brilliant, brilliant chef. That was his great thing. And the American agent says, look, you know, the problem is that fat guys who don't screw, they don't sell. Can you write me something about a thin guy who screws a lot? And I said, are you serious? And he goes, yeah, that always sells. So I took that information on board and kind of began to learn the hard lessons of trying to get published. And then I had another go, and then it was only on the fourth go, so I think I was about 29, that I finally got through, and that became the first novel, which is The Calligrapher. And so I've been writing novels ever since.
So that's a romantic comedy with, of course, the works of a very famous poet weaving through it.
Yeah, I mean, as you can probably tell, I'm just madly obsessed by the English language. I mean, it's the greatest gift I think the country's given to the world, more than even democracy and the internet. Because language is the means by which we understand one another and each other, and also how we communicate through generations and across time. And also, I strongly believe, as is in the new book, Let Go My Hand, the idea of language being thought, so that if you, for example, learn a poem, in that case, John Donne, those words are available to your neurons in some other thought. And I sort of think there is actually almost a biological or chemical thing that goes on when you increase your vocabulary. Who knows how words are stored? But the more you do it, the more articulate you become. And I think it's not related directly to intelligence. It's more related to just exposing yourself to the words and rhythms of great writers. That book's all about John Donne, not just about John Donne. It's a story, it's a love story with a great twist at the end, a modern day romantic comedy in a way, yeah, as you say. But the chapter titles all take themselves from John Donne poems. And what the guy is doing, the hero of the novel, is he's transcribing those. He's a calligrapher.
He's a thin guy that screws.
He's a thin guy who screws a lot, yeah. And and he goes through the John Donne poems and basically begins to learn about love. So he moves from being a boy, kind of priapic boy, to a wiser guy who falls in love genuinely for the first time in his life. And what he doesn't realise is the poems are tracking that movement. And so I just put a little bit of the Donne into each chapter. And John Donne is a great, great hero of mine, a wonderful, probably for my money, the greatest poet, excepting Shakespeare.
Your next book, Self-Help, or Pravda, as it's called in some territories, was long-listed for the Man Booker Prize. It's set in Russia, presumably drawing again on some aspects of family history, and also, I imagine, completely stepping up your writing career a degree because of the Booker nomination.
Yeah, I mean, my second book was a deliberate effort by me to try and write something, you know, a bit more taxing, actually, just harder for me in terms of the writing job, and to really try and put everything into it. And I did that. I went to Russia because obviously my mother's half Russian and I'd always wanted to write from the Russian side of things. So I lived in St. Petersburg on and off, as long as the visa would allow, wrote lots of the sections there. And that novel is kind of based on my mother's story as well. So it's quite a personal book to write. It's a great, great story, which I won't give away the end, but it tells the story of some twins who go through a series of discoveries, and one of which is deeply involves a very, very crazy Russian pianist. I've deliberately taken the view as a writer to try and improve. I'm quite a student of it. So I studied English at university. I felt after I wrote The Calligrapher, I didn't want to repeat myself. And one of the things that can happen to you, oddly, if you're really successful as well, is that you write the same book over and over again. And that's perfectly fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But it's not what interested me. What interested me was getting better at the craft.
So next came a book about a river, a jungle, a sinister colonel. But this is the Amazon, not the Congo. Tell us about The Devil's Garden.
So during the course of my, I think, 35th birthday or something, I went and stayed in the Amazon with a friend of mine who is a researcher. And we ended up staying in this, you know, bizarre place quite far into Peru. And there were two people living there, these two old German guys. And these guys had been studying ants all their lives. And what they were trying to do was reverse Charles Darwin and Richard Dawkins' theory of evolution. They were trying to prove that ants cooperate across the nest, even when it's deleterious to their own survival. So there is, in fact, an ant that's called a suicide ant. I got quite into that because I thought it was a hugely great and interesting idea. So I used that very basic science thing as the job of a guy who goes to the jungle and who involves himself deeper and deeper into a series of desperate and bad fights and happenings, including all the things that are going on there, such as logging and mining and oil and cocaine and all the things that happen there. And I basically really liked that story because, in a way, the Amazon is the nexus of all our decisions. So when you go there, it's the opposite of being in the West, in that if you make a decision that has real world immediate consequences, if you decide you're going to pull out the oil, it's not a kind of conceptual article in a newspaper. It means that's what you've decided and down go the trees. But I also wanted to write it from the other side because the Peruvian government make the point quite reasonably that they are trying all the time to develop in order to help the country. And every time they come up with a new development, we say, oh, no, you can't do that. So they tried to build these dams because we said you shouldn't pull out the oil. So they built dams for hydroelectric. And, of course, that flooded all the rivers and killed. So it's just a much more complicated thing. And so I just wanted to write a thriller that was set in the middle of that. And, again, to just push hard on my own whatever ability I've got to try and find a way to write better, because you're just trying to get better. And so in that book, you know, tried to pare down the style, get rid of overlong sentences and adjectives, and just really try and, Martin Amis, who I once interviewed, called it plain song. He said try and write in plain song.
I'm not sure that you could get any better with this beautiful new book, Let Go My Hand. It's tender, it's darkly funny, it's about family secrets, death, love. The Lasker family, very interesting. Lots of similarities, of course, between them and your own family. Mm-hmm.
Yes, well, thank you very much for being so kind about it. I'm sure many writers will tell you when they come on the show, it's very difficult for the person who's written the novel to have much perspective early. I can talk about my other books now because years have passed and I sort of know what was going on. This has only just been published and I probably only finished the editing process 6 months ago. So it's very difficult for me to really say what's happening with this book particularly, but it does seem to have come out in that great organic way of writing. It does seem to have come out well, and I'm very pleased with the way it's constructed. The characters are, you know, it's never your own family. It's not like that. The way that most writers create character is actually by confecting. So what you usually do is you'll have three or four or five things from different people or different sources, and you'll start to put them together. And then a bit of magic happens maybe 60 pages in when the new person you've created, who is an amalgam or a collage of lots of different things, starts to then be real unto themselves. James Wood, the critic, has a great line on Tolstoy where he says that Tolstoy's characters are so real because they're so real to themselves. Mm. And I love that, the idea that, you know, in a way, what Tolstoy does is he says, this is all going on and here's just a page of their lives. And you have that feeling when you read, you feel that they're all rushing around Russia doing things. And that's such a skillful thing to do.
So of course, you mentioned Tolstoy at the beginning of the book.
I love the Russian writers, of course, but that's what's happened a little bit with this book, that these people are so real that you do feel they're not in fiction at all. It's rather that they've arrived in the book for the time of the novel. So that's great, and I'm really pleased with that. And I think with this one, it's a lot more, you're right to say tender. There's a lot of love flying about, but it's very complex, and I want to try and get that. You know, most of us in most of our lives live in ways that are very complex in terms of our relationships with our fathers and mothers. Most people love their father and mother, and I certainly love mine, but it's a complicated form of love. It's not straightforward, and you're cross about these things and happy about those things. And the same with our children. So I wanted to really write that truthfully, not in a kind of glib fiction way, but in a real way, and capture that multivalent feeling that we all have towards our parents and towards our brothers and sisters, but at the same time soaked or marinated in the community of their family love. I mean, they love each other. So that's what I was going for, and then I just put it under huge dramatic pressure by obviously the end of the story. So that gives you what all writers are looking for as well, which is dramatic kinesis. One of the things that's really important when you're writing a long piece of fiction is that there is a sense of movement. Books that wallow, I mean, if you're a genius like Tolstoy, you can do it, but if you're not a genius like Tolstoy, then you've got to really watch out for that, especially if you're writing about families where the plot is lighter. You need to make sure it's got kinesis. So that's what this book had, which is great.
And it has it in every sense of the word, because also, of course, they're on this road trip. And I don't think it's a plot spoiler to say they're on their way to Dignitas.
They are.
Of course, that brings us to the whole question of assisted suicide. Mm-hmm. Is it something that you sign up to?
Personally speaking, absolutely no question. Yeah, I mean, there's a great piece to be written by somebody, or a great article to be written by somebody, which is that I think that what's happening a lot is that in the UK, we still live on the fault line between a kind of pagan Greek-Roman culture and Christian culture. And the Christian culture gives us, you know, commandments, as it were. And the pagan culture sort of says, well, actually, it's your own life. It's dignified death. So, you know, in Rome, suicide is a very dignified thing. And I think when you see the British people uncertain, like over Easter eggs and Easter bunnies versus it's often that thing, which is, on the one hand, we are actually a pagan country, or we were, and on the other hand, we are a Christian country. And I think the assisted death argument or arguments falls very close to the fault line between those two instincts in us. I mean, part of us thinks, for goodness sake, you know, if it were my life, I would want to be able to decide for myself. The other part of us thinks, well, hang on a minute, we can't have that going running wild through society. But having talked to the people that have been through it, I'm absolutely clear in my own mind, there's no question that we should, with the proper safeguards, allow it. I mean, absolutely no question. I mean, the most interesting thing is all the family members said to me, at the time, it was really, really, really tough. But 5 years later, we look back and we think Jack or Jill would be dead by now anyway. And what a great way to go, because we would have had all the pain. We would have had all the grief. But in fact, we had a great way of saying goodbye. So I'm very pro.
Identity is a big theme in the book. Do you think that it's important to be able to define our own identity, or is it enough just to be? I mean, for instance, can you define your own identity?
It's a great question. I think a lot of the inner life of human beings is devoted to that discussion with themselves. So on the one hand, I am the child of your parents. I am British. I am Welsh. I am whatever I am. And those kind of labels affix to us and define us. On the other hand, we are all of us constantly thinking, well, I don't like these straitjackets. I don't like to be just that. I'm not just that, in fact. You know, if only you knew me better, you'd know that I'm much calmer or much funnier. And people forever telling you that. I mean, even presidents say, well, actually, if you knew me better, you'd know that I didn't just march into Iraq. It was really, they're always trying to tell you that. So I think this question of identity, which is both outwardly directed and inwardly directed, is really good subject for fiction, and certainly one of my subjects, because those two things are continually in conflict, I think, with almost everybody, and certainly people who read and write. So it's a very valuable and interesting area to write about.
In all of your books, there are similar themes. For instance, twins. Where does that come from? Why does that keep popping up?
Well, that's as random as possible. As it so happens, after writing all these books about twins, I had twins. I mean, not me, my wife. I don't know. It's because I think, I was talking about this the other day, I think it's because I have such a close relationship with my own siblings that I sort of feel you've got to make them twins in fiction to make it believable, because they're so intimate.
In terms of the fact that there are similar themes, I wonder if writing each book was a very different experience, or if you follow a roughly similar work pattern.
One thing I do, which I think may be different to other people, is I write every day. Now, that might actually only be a very short time, but I do write fiction every day, because I think that fiction is a bit like casting a spell, and you have to cast it over yourself first. And if you go away on holiday and try and do 2 weeks, you spend the first 3 days moving the furniture around, then you can't remember why you've written anything, then it doesn't make sense. Only by about day six are you back inside it and starting to work effectively. And if you work every day, then the thing is present in your mind more continually and more available to you. So you're able to make character and things decisions all the time. As I say, it doesn't mean necessarily that you do huge numbers of hours, and certainly the weekend it'll be half an hour only. But I do try and do that because I like to keep it close to the top of my mind. I think also the world starts to suggest itself to you when you keep the story high in your mind. So things start to be germane that if you got lost in your life again, you wouldn't notice. So I think that's different to how other people work. But generally, it's just the same as everyone. It's this kind of gradual gathering of endlessly disparate strands and honing until eventually it starts to look like a book. And even then, off you go again, and you're just trying to pull it. The hardest thing to teach, and I think it's almost impossible to teach, is structure. Because structuring creative work, drama, plays, movies, novels is so hard to learn, but you do have to learn it. And whenever you read something that's really good, one of the reasons it'll be really good is because it's structured really well.
And have you begun structuring the next one?
I've started, yeah. I mean, at this stage, it's just pulling all the ideas together. And excitingly, but troublesomely, I have two very different ideas that I'm working on. So I'm not sure which one I'll back yet, but soon I'll know.
Edward Docks on Meet the Writers. Let Go My Hand is published by Picador and it's out now. You've been listening to Meet the Writers. Thanks to Claire Urban. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.